Today's show is sponsored by Cloud Academy. Listen up, y'all. This is a great offer. With everyone using the same cloud platforms, winning and losing comes down to having the best talent to build products better and faster. Cloud Academy is the training platform of choice for Fortune 500 companies and thousands of tech professionals around the world. Thousands of video courses, learning paths, practical hands-on labs in real-world cloud environments, Cloud Academy has tools designed to help teams assess, build, and validate critical cloud skills. Most importantly, Cloud Academy stays agile, challenging you with new content, labs, and tons of features that ensure your skills stay relevant and everyone can level up. They cover everything from cloud certifications to DevOps to security to programming languages. You can get started now at cloudacademy.com. For a limited time, Cloudcast listeners can lock in 50% off the monthly price for life. Just put in the coupon code CLOUDCAST at checkout. It's a great way to pursue certifications or just build cloud expertise. Again, that's cloudacademy.com and use the coupon code CLOUDCAST to lock in 50% off the monthly price.
Cloudcast Media presents from the massive studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. This is The Cloudcast with Aaron Delp and Brian Gracely, bringing you the best of cloud computing from around the world.
Good morning, good evening, wherever you are, and welcome back to The Cloudcast. We are coming to you live from the massive Cloudcast studios here in Raleigh, North Carolina. Hope everybody is doing well. We continue to cruise through December, kind of mid-December, and we are very close to the light at the end of the tunnel of this. Oh, what a year 2020 has been. So we are going to spend most of this show talking about the AWS reInvent. reInvent's a little bit different this year. Usually it's a one-week event. This year it is a three-week event, and obviously we want to be able to get you as much information as you can, kind of as early as you can. So we're going to focus mostly on kind of the big announcements from week one. We will put some stuff in the show notes about week two and week three announcements as they come along. But we're going to kind of focus today mostly on week one. And we're going to kind of skip cloud news of the week. I will put some stuff in the show notes. There were a couple of interesting acquisitions that went on, as there typically are this time of year. But just a couple of thoughts post-AWS summit, or reInvent, I guess, if you will, before we dive into sort of all the announcements. You know, and there just a couple of things that kind of jumped out at me as I was thinking about it. You know, the first one is, you know, we had a big outage. Well, not we. AWS had a big outage about a week and a half, 2 weeks ago, just before reInvent. And one of the things that jumped out at me was, you know, there's always the there's the crowd that sort of says, oh, you know, this, you know, anytime a big outage happens, you should be thinking about multi-cloud. Okay, I get that. Typically, they do that because they're, you know, that's kind of financially incentivized to drive that. Then you've got the crowd that sort of comes out and says, well, you know, anybody who had an outage because of this, it's their own fault. They should design around multi-region and multi-zone and so forth. And I get that. There's always going to be sort of apologists for any technology. But the one thing that really jumped out at me was, you know, how little we know as each of these new postmortems come out, just kind of how interconnected behind the scenes the AWS services are. And so while it's, you know, it's great to sort of talk about designing around redundancy and resiliency of availability zones and regions and so on and so forth, we don't really know how AWS is built. To be honest with you, like, I've never seen a great analysis of kind of what goes on behind the scenes. It's, you know, this one was tied very much into Kinesis, but there was things tied to API Gateway, there was other services and so forth. And obviously the outage was tied to, kind of a normal operational thing that went awry and so on and so forth. But it kind of jumped out at me that we don't really know kind of how it's designed. And, you know, I know we don't necessarily know exactly how the internet works. I know we don't necessarily know a lot of things, but for something that's that big, I'm a little bit surprised sometimes that people are as shocked. And I think what that tells me is there's a huge opportunity for AWS to be much more transparent about, you know, where are the dependencies? And I don't know that we can necessarily design around those, but it would be nice to sort of know. And I'm sure folks who, you know, make their living designing around complex AWS environments would probably like to know a little bit more about how that happens. So a couple of things that jumped out at me was, watching Andy Jassy give his keynote. Same guy, same CEO, essentially, president and CEO of AWS for the entire life cycle of AWS, 15 years now. So it's a huge long run from, you know, basically $0 to now about a $45 billion run rate. So pretty interesting. It's a long run. He doesn't seem to be slowing down on that, which is very interesting in the tech industry. We don't typically see one person continue to lead from startup phase to growth phase to continued growth phase for that long. And the last thing that sort of jumped out at me that I've been thinking about was, you know, we have this fascination in tech about, you know, who are the founders of things, who are the creators of things, things that we're really dependent upon. So we know, you know, Steve Jobs was, you know, influential in the iPhone. We know that Linus Torvalds was influential in Linux and, you know, lots of other things. We don't really know the creators of a lot of the things in AWS. Like, for example, do you know who created S3? I don't. You know, one of the most important services in the entire internet, and you never hear from that person. You don't really know who that person is. And that's one of the really interesting mysteries of AWS is, you know, other than James Hamilton and Werner Vogels and Andy Jassy and a couple of other people, you don't really know who the people are behind it. And that's really sort of interesting for something that's become so huge in the internet and so huge in cloud computing that we don't know more of the individuals that are actually were the creators of this thing. So anyways, it just got me thinking. It's not terribly, terribly important, but just a couple of random thoughts before we really dive into kind of the bulk of the week one announcements from AWS. And we'll be doing that right after the break. Today's show is sponsored by Okta. In these challenging times, we're all looking for simplicity, something that just works. The last thing you want to do is spend time building authentication for your new curbside pickup app. Because if you're spending time building your own authentication systems, it's time spent not making your customers happy. This is where Okta makes it simple. Okta's cloud-based authentication services are easy to set up, and they already integrate with the tools and applications you use today. Okta is trusted by companies like HPE, Splunk, CarMax, GitLab, and Cengage, plus many, many more. To take the hassle out of your authentication needs, visit okta.com/cloud and learn how to get started today. That's okta.com/cloud. Today's show is sponsored by Datadog. Start monitoring EC2, RDS, ECS, and all your other AWS services in minutes with Datadog. Whether you have 10 instances or 10,000, Datadog automatically tracks hosts as you scale. Visualize metrics, automatically alert on anomalies, and collaborate across teams to quickly troubleshoot issues before they escalate. Give it a try with a free 14-day trial by visiting datadog.com/cloudcast, and Datadog will send you a comfy, complimentary t-shirt. That's datadog.com/cloudcast. We're back, and this is the show that we do every year right around the time of reInvent or right after reInvent, where we try and kind of summarize a lot of the announcements. We try and do a little bit, sort of a sub impersonation, if you will, of what Andy Jassy now does for, you know, 3+ hours during the AWS keynote. So what we tried to do was make a big list. We borrowed from a lot of other new lists that are out there of kind of keeping up with all the announcements that happened during reInvent. reInvent this year, a little bit different as almost every single conference was this year. reInvent is a 3-week-long event now instead of a 4 or 5-day event. Obviously, it's nearly impossible to sort of keep up with all the AWS announcements because not only do they come out sort of fast and furious during reInvent, but they come out throughout the year and, you know, it's all kinds of random stuff. Sometimes it's a big announcement, a big new service. Sometimes it's just some random thing like a price change or, you know, an availability in some new region of the world or something like that. But what we try to do was really kind of focus in on the ones that Andy Jassy kind of highlighted. The one nice thing that AWS did this year was they did pull together some summary blogs that we will put in the show notes that kind of list everything. So obviously we won't get to all of them, but we will try and get to a bunch of them and try and put some commentary around them because just listing all the announcements, you know, isn't necessarily super valuable to you, the listeners, but, you know, kind of putting some commentary around it, I think is always interesting. So I'm going to go ahead and just kind of jump in. I'm going to do this sort of in sections, kind of the same way that AWS does it for in terms of organizing things. So let's start with compute. Compute obviously being the biggest revenue area for AWS. You know, this includes compute, lots of different compute resources, containers, serverless, everything that has to do with basically compute. I think the numbers that we hear typically are somewhere between 60 and 65% of all AWS revenues come and are associated with compute. So obviously a really big area. So there was a couple of big announcements and I'll kind of hit through. I'm going to kind of go through some lists and then I'll come back with some commentary. They announced EC2 Mac OS instances, so sort of going after what Mac Stadium does these days. They announced the AWS Inferentia chip. They announced the AWS Trainium chip. A couple of these were both new ARM-based chips that AWS has been developing, kind of an evolution of what they've been doing with Graviton. They talked a lot about the work that they're doing around ARM, and you know, it's becoming very, very obvious that that the ARM space, in terms of performance and so forth, I think they said about 40%, 45% better performance than, you know, Intel and AMD chips. They did announce something called Habana Gaudi-based EC2 instances. So again, they started off with a whole bunch of new EC2 instance types and chipsets that were focused on, you know, AI and inferencing, building training models around that, having specific chipsets around training models. But there really was an interesting sort of, you know, new trend. You know, 3-4 years ago, Intel was always front and center on stage, and you know, they talked about sort of them building specific new chips for AWS. Now AWS is very much moving into building their own chipsets and being very ARM focused, and so haven't obviously given up on having Intel chipsets available in the EC2 portfolio, but we are seeing more and more, and obviously AWS is making a much bigger deal about that. On the container space, they announced a couple of interesting new initiatives. One was called ECS Anywhere, and then they also had one called EKS Anywhere. So in essence, this was them taking their both ECS and EKS and the associated Fargate that goes with it, but mostly ECS and EKS, the scheduling systems, and allowing those to run anywhere. So on premises for customers. They didn't explicitly call out that these can run in other clouds, but that sort of got inferred through later discussions with AWS and in blogs and so forth. You know, this is part of them sort of hearing the market telling them, hey, you know, we can't run everything in the AWS cloud for various reasons. It is sort of interesting. The ECS Anywhere offering is a managed service. The EKS offering is not necessarily a managed service. And one follow-up that came with the EKS Anywhere was they did open source and will be providing their EKS as a Kubernetes distro. So this is sort of interesting, you know, essentially them now being in the software business, you know, providing an upstream piece of software that becomes an open source distro. So that's going to compete against lots of other Kubernetes offerings that are in the market, whether it's Red Hat OpenShift or Rancher or VMware Tanzu or, you know, dozens of others out there. So interesting to see VMware beginning to push their container capabilities out into other places. Obviously, they've done lots of stuff with Outposts and Snowballs and Snow appliances and so forth, but expanding that out. A couple interesting things in the Lambda space or the serverless space. They reduced the billing timeframes from 100 milliseconds down to 1 millisecond, so getting really, really granular about how you can bill Lambda functions. They expanded out how big a Lambda function can be. Now it can be up to 100 meg of RAM and 6 vCPUs, so some pretty big sets of business logic that can run as a Lambda function now. And they introduced something that's called Lambda Container Support. So what that now means is instead of just being able to sort of zip file a Lambda, you can now use container tools and container packaging to package your code and upload that. So kind of gets into this overlap between what is Lambda, what is Fargate, and so forth. And the last thing they announced around compute was the AWS Proton project or offering, which is kind of a PaaS-like offering, a very kind of opinionated way of getting from pipelines to, you know, kind of putting guardrails around writing code, deploying code, and then running the code in production. So, you know, Amazon has never sort of, they've always sort of said, well, Elastic Beanstalk's not really a PaaS offering. Proton sort of feels like it's sort of that next generation of what people used to call PaaS. Now we sort of call opinionated pipelines and opinionated ways of deploying and so forth. So, you know, kind of interesting that they must have heard something in the marketplace that told them, hey, you know, those ideas and those concepts are still really important to us. Please bring something like that back. So it'll be interesting to sort of see how that pans out. Taking a breath. Let's dive into storage a little bit. Storage was interesting because AWS had previously done a AWS Storage Day a couple of weeks prior to AWS reInvent. So storage by itself has gotten so big. Obviously, there is a lot of data that's not only maintained in AWS, but moves around between AWS and so forth. So they had an entire storage day. I'll put some pointers to some of the announcements they'd made over there. A couple of things that they announced around storage specific to reInvent was GB3 volumes for EBS, so faster, less expensive volumes for EBS called GP3. So lots of folks saying basically if you run GP2 volumes, you should just move to GP3 volumes. You're going to get better performance and it's going to be sort of cheaper and faster. The second one was sort of an interesting announcement. They announced was called IO2 IOPS and then IO2 Block Express. And in essence, they framed this up as if they basically built a SAN, a storage area network, in the cloud. So, you know, for those of you that are familiar with things like EMC and NetApp and Hitachi and all those other kind of big SANs that people bemoaned, as the cloud became more and more prevalent, the types of things that SANs solve for, you know, basically collecting massive amounts of disks, massive amounts of IOPS, being able to do replication all over the place. AWS is now offering that in what they call IO2 Block Express. So again, they really kind of pitched this as sort of a cloud SAN, if you will, or an architecture for cloud SAN. And then one other thing that wasn't necessarily in the keynote, but was in Storage Day, or actually wasn't, it kind of dropped somewhere in between, something called Storage Lens. And this allows cross S3 visibility. So we'll put some details in there. The folks over at Corey Quinn's podcast did a really nice job of kind of talking about Storage Lens. This essentially lets you see what's going on, not just in one S3 account, but across lots of accounts, and kind of gives you some default analytics and so forth around that. So, nice set of tools now for people that store a lot of things in S3. So that kind of covered compute and storage, the things that, as much as we all talk about the thousands and hundreds of features that AWS have, everything sort of falls back to being compute and storage. And then there's some other things that go on top of it. But the bulk of revenue from AWS still comes from compute and storage. Now, let's dive down into databases. It was very obvious in the database space that they wanted to kind of go after two things. Number one, they continue to talk about serverless database. So the Aurora database, which is lots of different flavors of an RDS on top of it, and then on the back end, essentially, not having to manage the operation. So Aurora serverless V2, much better scaling, much more granular scaling was announced. And then they kind of really went after Microsoft and really Microsoft SQL databases. They made a big deal about, the feedback they had gotten from customers about, Microsoft's way of pricing SQL database and tying it to Microsoft Cloud and some other things like that. So they introduced two things. First was called Babelfish, which is a way of translating from MySQL or Microsoft SQL to Postgres for Aurora. So it's basically a way to take, drop this thing in. It will take all of your, database reads, writes, and all the functions that go on with databases from that sort of Microsoft SQL, and I think eventually MySQL, and translate that to Postgres. And the whole idea is that this Babelfish technology will do it without you having to change anything about your application. So it'd be interesting to see if this works. I think people are going to be very, very interested in, especially if, it is another way to migrate away from one sort of vendor database into maybe another vendor database, maybe unlock some licensing stuff and so forth. And the other thing was they open source Babelfish. So, obviously this is a space that can become very, very complicated. So they're trying to take advantage of people in the community who may want to work with this from an open source perspective. So Babelfish, their way of really going after the Microsoft database market, trying to help, again, migrate just the way they same way they did, having gone after Oracle databases 3, 4, 5 years ago and pushing a lot about how they've been migrating Oracle databases into the AWS cloud. The next area was what I'll call sort of data and AI and ML. So you kind of reach a point in any AWS keynote where they sort of stop talking about infrastructure and start talking about data and AI and ML. And it's kind of a preview because later, a week later, 2 weeks later, they have almost an entire week about AI and ML and big data and so forth. So we'll try and cover some of those maybe in a later show, dive into them a little bit more, make sure they get into the show notes. But a couple of things they dove into. The first one was something that was called Glue Elastic View. And this was really their way of talking about services they're going to connect all the different ways that you're going to store data in AWS. So essentially, it was kind of hitting at this is a big data lake without ever really calling out Snowflake, who's obviously doing extremely well, runs a service on AWS, but also runs on lots of other clouds. So this was sort of their way of going, hey, we're going to make it easier for you to store your data no matter where in AWS, whether it's in a database or S3 or somewhere else. And We're going to provide a bunch of tools to help you kind of build data lakes on top of that. And then obviously at some point, analytics tools and other query tools on top of this. So it felt very much, without them explicitly going after and calling out Snowflake, it felt like their first foray into sort of, essentially trying to build a Snowflake competitor. Next couple of things they announced were in the SageMaker category. They announced both SageMaker Data Wrangler, and SageMaker Feature Store. Again, I'm not going to dive into these, essentially simpler ways to do AI and ML inferencing and building up training and so forth. Lots and lots of discussion about trying to bring AI and ML data science, if you will, to the masses. And SageMaker is really become that brand and a whole set of features that are trying to help with this. All right. Next section we really got into was around what we'll talk about as developers. And this was an interesting one because the developer space, there's a part of it that's specific to what you'd think of as kind of day-to-day enterprise application developers and so forth. And then there was a whole set of stuff on contact centers. And the day-to-day developer stuff was really interesting. And then I'll get into the contact center stuff in just a second. So first thing they announced was CodeGuru, which is a tool they announced previously. It did add support for Python, also added a bunch of security detection capabilities. The next thing they announced, which everybody got a big laugh out of, was Amazon DevOps Guru. So, the joke has always been that you can't buy DevOps. Well, now there is Azure DevOps, and now there is AWS or Amazon DevOps. This is essentially them building sort of an AI and ML driven tool to go look at your logs and other things that you might do and kind of notify you when you're doing things that aren't very DevOps-y or, could potentially cause some problems. So it's kind of, I guess, as the name implies, they're trying to match up what would be best practices to areas that you have that may be, failing. It'll be interesting to sort of watch what this does. Obviously, this is one of those areas that, a lot of people have really baked their career into being DevOps engineers and DevOps teams and so forth, and they're now going to, potentially get automated away by an AI or an ML tool. So that'll be interesting to watch. Now, the other part of this whole developer section was really focused around call centers. And I thought this was interesting because, they've talked about call centers in the past, and it was like, okay, well, that's interesting enough. I'd worked at companies in the past that did some call center technologies and IP collaboration, and I never thought that it was that huge a market. But what was really interesting, I saw an interesting statistic this week. I think it was from either Forrester or IDC. Something like 60 or 70% of all kind of AI bots, if you will, work in call centers, right? So, there's a huge, obviously, AWS does a lot of transactions on the retail side. They're learning a ton about, how to build these transactional bots and so forth in AI and ML. So they had a whole bunch of different things that were focused on this. Something that was called Amazon Connect Wisdom for call centers, Amazon Connect Customer Profiles, Contact Lens for Amazon Connect, Amazon Connect Tasks, Amazon Connect Voice ID, just a ton of things really targeting essentially eliminating the people behind call centers, trying to make as much of that highly automated, getting very customer focused, and basically taking probably a lot of the things that Amazon's learned from their own internal call centers and now turning that into tools that hundreds or thousands of other customers can then embed into their capabilities. So that was sort of an interesting thing to watch. The next area that was kind of interesting, and again, this is one of those ones that, if you followed Amazon for a long time or you followed AWS for a long time, you sort of see some patterns. And sometimes some things will come out and you'll kind of scratch your head and be like, what's going on there? What are they talking about? Why are they getting into this? And then you realize like so much of what Amazon does is they take what they do internally. They become very, very good at it. Obviously, they probably work between the Amazon teams and the AWS teams to build those technologies. And then at some point they realize we can monetize this. We can turn this into a profit center and take our best practices because we are probably way further ahead than anybody else and put those out in the marketplace. So a couple of interesting things, and these were all really in the kind of warehouse space or manufacturing space. So something called Amazon Monitron, and this was about monitoring industrial equipment. Obviously, AWS or Amazon has huge investments in factory floors or warehouse floors, robotics around that, and the equipment that moves those things around. So this helps monitor industrial equipment. Amazon Lookout for equipment. So this was something, again, monitoring equipment, monitoring the movements of humans and individuals. And then finally, Amazon Panorama Appliance, which is really kind of a way of enhancing smart closed caption TV feeds. And again, a lot of this comes from supposedly, or you know, what you would suspect, a lot of the things that they've learned internally about how to run their own warehouses and being able to extend that out in IoT, edge, manufacturing, smart manufacturing types of environments. So sort of an interesting you know, area that they spent a lot of time focusing on in the keynote, and obviously they feel like they've advanced their own technology enough to where this can become something they can turn into a you know, on-demand managed service. Now, finally, the last one, and this was kind of expected, but you're never really quite sure how Amazon's going to kind of introduce something new that everybody sort of expects. And one of the things that Amazon has been adamant about not talking about it not acknowledging, about not kind of recognizing in the market, was this concept that there was any other cloud but their own. Now, that's pretty normal that vendors don't you know, talk about anybody else. Amazon sometimes does. They like to do that thing where they say, we don't care about our competitors. They will sort of talk about where they think they are in the marketplace. They will talk at times about why they built a product because, you know, somebody doesn't do something well and they'll call out a competitor. But they've been really adamant about, we do not talk about hybrid cloud. We do not talk about multi-cloud. We will not allow our partners to talk about that. We do not allow our speakers to talk about those concepts. There is the AWS cloud, and then there's on-premises. And that's always been their stance. And what was really interesting was JPMorgan Chase came out as a customer, and this was one of the first customers that they came out and kind of gave a testimonial about what they were doing with AWS. And they mentioned the word hybrid cloud. And I thought, oh, well, that's foreshadowing, because there's no way AWS would allow that if they weren't going to announce something around hybrid cloud. And then in the last probably 5 or 10 minutes, Andy Jassy came out, kind of finished up the keynote, and he said, you know, there's been a lot of talk about hybrid cloud. We don't agree with most of the industry's definitions of hybrid cloud, whatever those things might be. And then they proceeded to sort of define what they thought hybrid cloud meant. And in essence, the AWS version of hybrid cloud means, obviously, AWS everywhere, AWS services everywhere, not really an acknowledgement of other clouds like Google or Azure or IBM Cloud or Oracle Cloud or Alibaba or anybody else. Now, essentially, AWS services, consistent APIs everywhere from AWS. And so they talked about a couple of things. The first was they announced two smaller Outpost platforms. So Outpost got announced last year, kind of a roll in a rack, roll in multiple racks into your data center that AWS would manage. They announced much, much smaller form factors. So like 2 RU, 1 RU, I think a 4 RU, somewhere between 1 and 4 RU, a couple of different form factors. So a smaller Outpost allows them to go after branch offices, moving vehicles, all sorts of stuff. The second thing they announced was more AWS local zones. So they announced last year something called a local zone, which was really initially targeted in Los Angeles, targeting the motion picture industry. They announced about 12 more local zones, so a lot of different cities around the world, essentially trying to create a metro, somewhat localized version of AWS that would have some number of services that AWS would run. They're going to put them into co-location facilities and so forth. And then finally, the last thing they announced was some new telco carriers to partner with around what they call AWS Wavelength, which is really kind of their way of taking an Outpost and aligning it to telco type of NFV services or telco services. So what they ultimately tried to do was say, hybrid cloud is the AWS cloud. It's a local zone. It is a Wavelength. It is a Outpost. It could be a snowball or a snowball edge or whatever. It basically just said, look, there's a lot of different places where AWS can run, from the biggest of the big cloud to sequentially smaller versions of smaller instances, whether they're fully hardware or software instances of AWS, all the way out to the edge. And in their world, that's what hybrid cloud means. So, you know, obviously there'll probably be quite a bit of debate in the industry about if that's the best definition. Is that only a self-serving definition for AWS? But it was very interesting because in the year 2020, with all the other craziness going on in the world, AWS announced that they do hybrid cloud. And for 10 years, they've said that doesn't exist. It's not a real thing. So take that for what it's worth. You know, the market sometimes agrees with AWS, sometimes they don't agree. But AWS always does a pretty good job of sort of eventually listening to the market and figuring out where they can make some money. So I sit here now with a fairly sore throat. I've talked for about 25 minutes straight. Actually, I've been talking all day, but I've been 25 minutes straight for this podcast. I am somewhat in awe of Andy Jassy, who does this for 3 hours. Now, granted, he takes a couple of breaks, small breaks. I tried to get through as many of the announcements that they went through on day one in the keynote. Again, I will put links in the show notes to as many other announcements as we can find, and you're welcome to go through them. But with that, I'm going to kind of wrap it up. Thank you, as always, for listening to the show. This is one of the shows that we do every year. Thank you for listening to the show. We've been continuing to grow even in this craziness of a year. So thank you for telling a friend. Thank you for spreading the word of the Cloudcast to your community. Thanks for telling people about what we do. Hopefully we can drive some new users, continue to find great content. And with that, we're going to wrap it up. Thanks for giving us a 5-star rating on iTunes and other places you get your podcasts. So we're going to wrap it up. Thank you so much for listening. And we will talk to you next week.
Thank you for listening to The Cloudcast. Please visit thecloudcast.net to find more shows, show notes, videos, and everything social media.